All right, so thank you very much for inviting me to give this talk. I'm going to talk about how to build a gauge invariant holographic dictionary in the context of ADS-CFT. The material I will talk about is based on a couple of works that I have done with my collaborators, Bartek Cech, Sam McAnlis, Ben Mosk, and James Sally, as well as some new results that Sam and I are currently preparing for publication. A related work has also been done by another group with representatives here, Michael Heller and Rob Myers. So let me start with some philosophy to set the stage. So gravity disfavors locality. There's plenty of evidence for it, both from the IR structure of gravity and from the UV. In the IR, for example, we have diffeomorphism invariants. This imposes on us constraints analogous to Gauss's law in electromagnetism. Essentially, it tells us that all our operators need to be invariant under diffeomorphisms, which essentially physically means that every excitation needs to be dressed with its gravitational field. This makes our operators non-local, necessarily. Another feature, a UV in nature feature, is the fact that at high energy scattering, at some point, gravity becomes important. Now, of course, one quickly runs into the usual non-renormalizability issues, and one is the UV completion to talk about these scattering processes. But regardless of the UV completion, there is a feature of gravity that will inevitably appear, and this is black hole resonances. Now, if one tries to study this regime, as Steve Giddings and collaborators have done in the past, one quickly finds that trying to incorporate black hole intermediate states results into cross-sections that violate fundamental bounds that local theories satisfy. So that's another source of tension between the two ideas, and perhaps the most profound evidence that gravity has non-locality in it is the holographic bound. Bekenstein formula tells us that we cannot fit as much information as we wish in a region of space. We are bounded by the area of the surface that encloses the volume. So this, of course, is in direct contradiction with the usual expectations from QFT, for example, which suggests that gravity includes some kind of non-local organization of the degrees of freedom. Now, this conflicts of principle lead to practical problems. For example, how do we even define operators in gravity? If our most successful theories to date, standard model, for example, is based on our ability to construct local operators. If these are off the table, then what are the right objects we should be building our theories in terms of? And second of all, what's the mathematics to describe these objects? Can we have a mathematical formalism which can help us describe the dynamics in a comprehensive way? And even if we solve these questions, we still have to somehow make connection with the familiar local language that we're all used to. Well, needless to say, I will not answer these questions today. These questions are older than myself. However, I will suggest an approach. And I will try to report progress in this approach in the context of ADS-CFT. ADS-CFT, in principle, solves this problem. It tells us that a quantum gravitational theory, with Andy de Sitter asymptotics, is dual to a conformal field theory in one lower dimension. However, ADS-CFT doesn't tell us how this is done. It doesn't give us an insight of how one should reorganize the degrees of freedom on the gravity side to get the CFT degrees of freedom, which we know how to talk about. So this is the question that I will focus on. And the guiding principle will be the fact that whatever the holographic translation does, it does it in a gauge invariant way, in a diffeomorphism invariant way. This will be the guiding principle. So the approach I will present is inspired by the Ryuta-Kaganagi formula. Ryuta-Kaganagi, almost a decade ago, proposed a correspondence between two seemingly completely unrelated quantities. One is the entanglement entropy in conformal field theories, in the boundary conformal field theory, and the other one is the area of minimal surfaces in the bulk. Roughly speaking, if you pick a subregion of the CFT, then and you find the minimal surface in the bulk, which is anchored on the subregion's boundary, then the area of the surface is computing the entanglement entropy of this subregion. Entanglement entropy is area of minimal surfaces, And regardless of whether you are a proponent of the program that space-time is built out of entanglement, one thing that I think everybody agrees on is that this is a good probe of the bulk theory. It has all the right properties that one could ask for a probe of the bulk gravity dual. It probes the geometry of the bulk interior. It's not just a quantity isolated somewhere far away towards the boundary. It is a diffeomorphism invariant object. Minimal surfaces are defined only with reference to the boundary. And as a bonus, it is a natural quantity in the conformal field theory. It's a quantity with physical significance. So we want to learn from the success of this correspondence and try to apply the lessons to the holographic dictionary in general. We're trying to use this idea to build a diff-invariant holographic dictionary. So the step would be, for example, to identify extended probes in the bulk, extended probes of the bulk field theory, which are dual to natural CFT objects. And of course, we would like to understand how we would like to pick them. We would like to pick these objects based on their usefulness, and we'd like to use them to make connection with the usual local degrees of freedom that we know are describing the ADS dual at low energies. And of course, the ultimate goal of this is to shed some light into one of the deep problems that has been around in ADS CFT for a long time. What is the CFT reason, what's the CFT principle that gives rise to a local bulk field theory in the bulk? Question?
Yeah, yes. This might be naive, but are you going to reconstruct just the classical bulk, or do you want us to think about reconstructing the entire quantum bulk?
Well, I'm interested in quantum field theory on a classical background. So it's the same classical approach. So treat the metric as a classical background, and I treat quantum fields on it. And I care about
interesting quantum gravity.
So I'm trying to understand how the translation works. So I want to do this at the regime where I have control on both of the theories. Ultimately, one would like to identify the right objects to talk about in the CFT and then try to extract lessons of what happens when you go away from the classical bulk. But at first, I'm going to try to even derive a correspondence at this semi-classical limit and then try to guide my way from there. So our approach will be simple, and it will be constructed. We will start from the simplest setting possible, which is free fields in the bulk. And we will make extensive use of symmetries to suggest and approach a road towards building a gauge invariant dictionary. We will see that even at this level, which is what we reported in our paper, a stereoscopic loop into the bulk, even in this picture, one actually gains a lot of mileage by using these different languages. The second step will be to include interactions. So I will not have all the time to give you all the details about interactions. This will be summarized in the paper that Sam and I are writing, and he's going to give a talk about it in a couple of weeks. But I will summarize the main picture, the main ideas that takes us forward towards including gravitational interactions in 2 plus 1 dimensions. This turns out to be the simplest setting in order to talk about interactions. And of course, the ultimate goal is to understand how to extend this dictionary to be valid for arbitrary interactions, local interactions in the bulk, which is currently work in progress, and there are some encouraging results, which I will not have time to mention. OK, so let's start with the simplest case, free QFT. So in Ryunda Yanagi, co-dimension 2 minimal surfaces were central. This was the object of interest. In general, every minimal surface is a natural, it's a natural diff-invariant object probe of the bulk. So both geodesics and all minimal surfaces have all the nice properties that one could wish for. So our idea was, let's associate operators with them. So how do we do it? The simplest way one can do this is to take the local bulk degrees of freedom, the local bulk fields, and integrate over the surfaces. For a large part of this discussion, I will focus on ADS3 for simplicity, where I only have one type of space-like minimal surface, just space-like geodesics, just to simplify the discussion. So in this case, I can define these phi tilde operators, these geodesic operators, which is essentially the integral of the local bulk field over the geodesic. So this is a particular type of transform. It's called the Radon transform. And it is a boundary bilocal. It is parameterized by two points on the boundary, which essentially selects my geodesic. Good, so there's no a priori reason why this is a good probe. I hope to convince you that it is by connecting to the CFT. So we're looking for the dual now. And we're looking for essentially a CFT bilocal, a natural CFT bilocal. But the operator product expansion provides us with an organizational principle of bilocals. What do I mean by that? Well, if I take any product of two local operators, let's make them primary, and let's make them of equal dimension, then their product can be expanded in the local basis of the CFT. But this expansion has structure in it. The only dynamical or theory-dependent parameters are the conformal dimensions of the families that appear, and these coefficients C, which are called the OP coefficients. This entire series of derivatives of a specific primary operator is entirely fixed by conformal symmetry. All these relative coefficients are fixed by symmetry. So the OPE naturally groups the contribution of every global family into this series over descendants. These are kinematically determined objects, which I will absorb in a new definition. The definition of this object B, which I will call the OPE block. So let me tell you a little bit more about what this, how one can talk about this object in a useful way. I defined it as this particular series over descendants. But the truth is that I can actually represent it in a different way, perhaps more convenient in certain cases. I can describe it as by taking the primary operator and smear it over the causal diamond selected by the two points. The smearing function, of course, is fixed by symmetry again. So one obtains this representation as this smeared diamond. I'm going to be using this picture in general to describe this block later on. And just to give you an idea, the smearing function is just a function. But there's a nice formal way of expressing it as a ratio of a three-point function over a two-point function.
Are you using 2 plus 1 for illustration purpose, or is it that all you're going to say is invalid for?
So I'm using 2 plus 1 for illustrative purposes, and because it avoids some technical issues that I will have to explain, the results that I'm describing here will be more general. For example, yes. What exactly? Let's.
In higher dimensions, you have points and you have spheres.
That's so. In higher dimensions, I have a choice to make. I can talk about the OPE block corresponding to two space-like separated points. Of course, in this case, I don't have a causal diamond to describe it. There is a smeared representation of this, but it's not that useful in that case. So one just is restricted to this other definition of a series over descendants. Just in 2 plus 1, it's easier to describe it in terms of this way because it makes computations easier. But in higher dimensions, I have other objects I can consider too. For example, I can consider the analogous object, which is choose a causal diamond of a sphere, for example, and smear the operator there. This is another object I can consider. So in higher dimensions, we get a larger zoo of objects. That's why I'm restricting to ADS3 here to minimize the distractions. But yes, we can extend this in various ways in higher dimensions. So much about the OPE block. And the reason why I'm introducing this is because, well, it turns out that if we have free fields in the bulk, then the geodesic operator and the OPE block are duals to each other. So this is the baby version of our gauge invariant dictionary. It's, of course, of limited validity. But it's actually very useful, and it's the first step towards building a more general case. So let me explain a little bit. Let me actually prove it for you. The proof actually goes through an intermediary structure, which is actually very useful. So this is kind of a digression, but it will be useful in a bit. Geodesic operators and OPE blocks are boundary bilocals. They essentially live on the space of pairs of points. Well. Equivalently, in ADS, in the case where the boundary is two-dimensional, this pair of points, the space of pairs of points, is also the space of causal diamonds as well. So let's give a name to this space. Let's call it kinematic space. So essentially, for every geodesic in ADS3 marks a point in our kinematic space, and so does a causal diamond in the CFT. And this space has geometric structure. Conformal symmetry helps us identify this structure. I'm giving you the metric here of the kinematic space of space-like points in arbitrary dimensions. Then let me explain to you what you see here. X mu and y nu are the coordinates of the two boundary points. And I mu nu is a tensor structure, which is fixed by symmetry, and I'm giving it here. You may have seen this before. It's the same tensor structure that appears in one-point functions of vector primaries in CFTs. There's a lot of things one can say about this space, but I will stick to the bare minimum, which is the fact that this space in general is of signature d, d. You can understand this in a simple way. We have d null directions. Where do these come from? Well, let's see what this metric actually does for us. It defines the distance between pairs of points. Any conformally invariant distance between two pairs of points will have to be a function of their cross ratio. But now let's imagine two bilocals that share a point. In this case, I have 3 points. There's no non-trivial cross ratio. And therefore, the distance between two bilocals that share a point will either be 0 or infinity. So we choose it to be 0. To give you some context in order to be thinking about this space, in two-dimensional conformal field theories, this admits an even simpler structure, which comes from the factorization of the conformal group. So kinematic space itself factorizes into a product of two de Sitter spaces. One is built out of the left-moving coordinates of the bilocal, and the other one out of the right-moving coordinates. So this is the structure. And now the reason why I introduced this is because it actually makes the proof of the correspondence particularly interesting, at least it organizes the proof in a particularly nice way. Because we will prove the dictionary by showing that both the OPE blocks and the geodesic operators behave as freely propagating fields in that space. They satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation. So let's see how this comes about. Well, OPE blocks are essentially defined by the transformation properties. One can read off the transformation properties from the OPE, and one can show that they transform as, by under a conformal map, they transform just the coordinates transform. The block itself is behaves as a scalar. Furthermore, we already said that they are built out of the elements of a specific conformal family. Therefore, they're eigenvectors of the conformal Casimir. The Casimir is what classifies the irreducible representations. In 2D CFTs, we have two Casimirs, a left-moving and a right-moving Casimir, and therefore we have two eigenvalue equations for it. But these two equations, two operator equations, can be translated to differential equations by just using the appropriate representation, and one finds that the appropriate differential equations are just two decoupled Klein-Gordons on the 2D Sitter spaces. The masses here are given by these eigenvalues, which are functions of the left-moving and right-moving weights. What about the bulk operators? Well, we already said that we have three fields in the bulk, and they satisfy the Klein-Gordon and ABS. We now want to derive an equation for the geodesic integral of that object. For that, we will use an elegant property of Radon transforms. The point is that the Radon transform of an ABS Laplacian can be converted to the kinematic space Laplacian acting on the Radon transform. That's called the intertwining property of it. And by using this, we can just directly find that the integral of a scalar field over geodesic satisfies the Klein-Gordon on the full kinematic space geometry. We're not quite done. This is one equation. We're looking for two equations to connect the two objects. But you can kind of sense where this other one will come from. We started from a function in ADS3, a function of three variables, and we mapped it to a function on a four-dimensional manifold, which was our kinematic space. Now, this has a lot of redundancy. Not all consistent functions, not all functions on kinematic space come from consistent Radon transforms. So we need some constraint equations to restrict us to the space of consistent Radon transforms, and these are called Jones equations. And if you work them out, for ADS3 in particular, the equation becomes the difference of the two Laplacians. So now you can see how we connected the previous picture by just taking the sum and the difference. We're almost done, but we need one last step. We've shown that the two objects satisfy the same differential equations. We want to show that they satisfy the same boundary conditions. And it turns out that these are actually provided to us by the coincident limit. We have bilocals, but we know how both of these bilocals behave once I'm taking the two points close to each other. The leading contribution to the OPE block comes from the primary operator. The leading contribution to the geodesic operator, well, if I'm taking the coincident limit, the geodesic approaches the boundary, I can use the extrapolate dictionary there, and I can express it in terms of the boundary operator, and we find the matching. We find that two objects match. Therefore, we conclude our proof. Geodesic operators are OPE blocks. So what is it used for? Yes, I'm sorry.
Maybe you're going to comment on it. There's a subtle key here, because your job equation tells the somehow says that the spin advantage, right?
Yes.
So what's the interpretation? It means that there's more, and for consistency of the CFT, you need to include all the possible OPE needed. So does that mean that this extra operator, that the CFT are somehow non-local, they don't live in DS3, or they don't exist in the bulk, or what's the interpretation of that?
I'm sorry, what operator are you asking for?
You show that operators which are local in the bulk corresponds to diagonal spin zero blocks.
Yeah, I consider the spin zero operator in the bulk, right? I have just a scalar field, and therefore it will be dual to the block of the spin zero operator.
So the spin on the boundary coincides with the spin in the bulk?
Yes, that's right, yeah. So I define these objects, and because I'm trying to look for a gauge invariant dictionary, but I need to be able to use it for something. So one thing that we can use it for is in order to reconstruct local bulk fields. We can use these geodesic operators to actually make connection to the local language. In general dimensions, this is easy to do. One just needs to identify all the geodesic. If we want to reconstruct an operator at a specific point, we just need to have access to all the geodesic operators that go through that point. And one needs to integrate over them with the appropriate smearing function, and that reconstructs the local operator. In two dimensions, in ADS3, one needs to work a little harder because of some technical complications. The idea is that you essentially find all geodesic operators that are a specific geodesic distance from your point, integrate over them, and then integrate over all distances. That's just a technical approach, but the spirit of the approach is the same. The main ingredient of it is that the reconstruction, the very definition of the point in the bulk, is done in a boundary-dependent way. I'm defining the point in the bulk as the collection of geodesics that intersect at the point. For a general manifold, of course, this is a hard problem to solve, but in principle, this correspondence defines the point in a diff-invariant way.
Excuse me?
Yes.
So the reconstruction is by all the geodesics passing through the point or all the geodesics in the space? Which one do you integrate over?
Right, so in even-dimensional ADS, I can reconstruct. There's a technical issue, there's a technical subtlety. In even-dimensional ADS, I can integrate over all the geodesics that go through the point, and that is enough to reconstruct it. For odd-dimensional ADS, one needs to integrate over all geodesics on a time slice. So in that case, there's this particular smearing function, and as you can see, I'm integrating over all. Well, this p is the distance, essentially. So I'm integrating over all distances here. So I'm actually integrating not over all geodesics of the space, but over that particular subset of geodesics. I need a codimension zero subset of geodesics, essentially.
I'm sorry, and you're always in empty areas?
Yeah, over here I'm talking about free fields. I have no coupling to anything. This is a kinematical correspondence so far. I will comment on that in a little bit. Yes?
And this is for scalar operators?
That's for scalar operators, yes.
And do you know how to use operators?
The reconstructing vector operators is more subtle.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in many occasions, in the mathematical literature, there are, in many occasions, there are existence theorems that there exist a reconstruction, but they don't provide with reconstruction formulas. So in this particular, for scalar fields, we can actually do the reconstruction. For vector fields, it's more subtle. So yeah, I'm not providing a reconstruction formula for vector fields here. But just to make connection, if you actually perform the procedure, and we did so, one just comes back to the usual Hamilton-Cabot-Lipschitz and Low prescription for how to describe local operators in the bulk. It's just a smeared boundary operator. The difference now is that we have deconstructed it in terms of these individual extended probes in the bulk. So Let me make something clear here. What we used, and you probably realized that from the proof I did, what is the principle behind this correspondence is conformal symmetry. It has used kinematics in a particularly convenient way to define objects that I consider conceptually advantageous. The idea behind it is simple, that if we are clever with the use of our symmetries, we can repackage our data into new operators, new degrees of freedom, which can help us make previous connections, connections that were previously invisible, can make them apparent. That was the case with this dictionary as well, because it kind of helped us tidy up various different results in ADS-CFT. One thing you already saw, we made connection with the reconstruction of local operators, but we also made connection with two other developments which seem kind of independent at first sight. One is the representation of conformal blocks as geodesic Witten diagrams, work done by Hanno, Kraus, Perlmutter, and Snively. And with another set of results, which is the connection between the first law of entanglement entropy and the linearized Einstein's equations in the bulk. Work done by too many people to mention. So I don't want to overwhelm you with information, but I think it's kind of a good thing to see how I've devoted a slide in explaining how exactly these two results come about, just to get a flavor of how easy one can express them in our language. So we already defined our OPE blocks as being the individual conformal family contributions to an OPE. But now you can imagine a four-point function. And you can OPE expand the two pairs of operators in terms of these blocks. And the four-point function admits a form as correlation functions of these blocks. But each of these blocks captures the contribution by a specific family. Therefore, their correlation function will be what we call conventionally conformal blocks. But if correlation function of these two OPE blocks is a conformal block, and these guys are represented by integrals over geodesics, then this conformal block becomes a propagator integrated along the corresponding geodesics. That is the essence of the result of these people. And we see that this is just a direct consequence of this correspondence. That was easy. The other connection is a little bit more tricky, but it just requires a couple of more steps. The starting point there is the first law of entanglement entropy. What this says, essentially, in the context that has been discussed in the literature, is the following. You start with a vacuum, and you do a small perturbation around it. The first order correction to the entanglement entropy is actually captured, of any subregion, I'm sorry, is actually captured by the expectation value of an operator associated with that region. This is called the modular Hamiltonian. Now, there's two observations. The first is that the change of the entanglement entropy by virtue of the Yuta Kagenagi is a change in the minimal surface in the bulk, in our case, the change of the length of the geodesic. But if you look at it more carefully, the first order change of the length of the geodesic is just the metric perturbation integrated over the geodesic. That's a particular example of a radon transform. Now, you can also check that the modular Hamiltonian, this operator here, which is associated to that region, is actually an OPE block as well. It is the OPE block of the stress tensor. One can see that by just observing at the form of this vacuum modular Hamiltonian, or just trace it back to the very definition of entanglement entropy, one can show that the only contribution to the first order to entanglement entropy comes from the stress tensor family. So if delta S is a radon transform and the modular Hamiltonian is an OPE block, this is just a particular instance of our dictionary. And that's great, because we have already said that a kinematical property of the OPE blocks, which is essentially the conformal Casimir eigenvalue, is connected with the free equations in the bulk. The free equations in that case being the linearized Einstein equations. So we see that this comes about from our dictionary naturally as well. So the main point that I want to communicate with this first discussion is that, first of all, we need to think of the holographic translation in terms of diffeomorphous invariant objects. Second, we can identify such objects in a relatively natural way, and we see that if we think about them in a clever way, we find a natural CFT description as well. And the third is that describing these objects is not nearly as ugly as one would have thought initially, because we saw that there is this organizational principle, this kinematic space structure, which helps us talk about them in a simple way, in a conventional way. So taking this, so if I convince even for a subset of this of these three features, then I guess this encourages us to push that correspondence further and think of how does dynamics fit into that picture. I will not talk about general interactions. I will talk about gravitational interactions in 2+1 dimensions. But let me make a comment on how dynamics come into play in our picture. Well, so far we have introduced these correspondences, geodesic operators and blocks, which essentially means the following. If our bulk field is free, the only non-trivial correlation function it has really is two-point functions. So this essentially means that if I take the correlation function, for example, of a geodesic operator and a boundary operator, which is this simple propagator integrated over this geodesic, I can reproduce the same result by just substituting the operator with the block. Now, if I have interactions, I can have higher point, non-trivial higher point functions. So, for example, for a cubic interaction, I can have this type of Witten diagram. The point is that in this case, I cannot substitute this geodesic operator with a block. We need to correct our definition. So the geodesic operator will not just be the OPE block, but it turns out that it will be a sum of blocks. Of course, the dressing of this operator, the correction of that, is perturbative. Here it's suppressed by n, because the interaction in the bulk is perturbative. But the idea is that by including an infinite series of other OPE blocks, which are associated to the so-called multi-trace operators in the bulk, the multi-trace operators in holographic CFTs, this actually recovers this correction.
Sorry, up to now you were for a generic CFT. So what do you mean by n here is just a central charge of the CFT?
Yes, that's right. Well,
what do you mean by multi-trace block in a random CFT?
In a random CFT, good. So that's where we deviate from the discussion of general CFTs. Everything I've said in the first part is purely kinematical, so you can do it in arbitrary CFTs. Mm-hmm. But now we want to start introducing local interactions in the bulk. Not every CFT is expected to have a dual description in terms of local of a locally interacting field theory in an ADS space.
So what are things that they need to satisfy?
Exactly. So we're following a constructive approach, and you see that the first thing that needs to satisfy is that these guys need to be in the spectrum.
What is the CFT definition of multi-trace block?
Good. So multi-traces can be thought of as following. One can take, generally speaking, you can construct the multi-trace operators in the following way. Take single-trace operators, just the normal operators which are dual to the low energy fields in the bulk, and take products, perhaps with a bunch of derivatives between them. And take the limit where all the operators in this product are coincident. Of course, you have to perform an appropriate normal ordering, an appropriate symmetrization, but the idea is that you can construct quasi-primary operators by products of the single traces. These are other operators in the spectrum of the CFT, in the spectrum of holographic CFTs.
Yeah, they're already in the spectra, so they're already the operators you talked about before. Right?
The multi-trace operators, let me explain something.
Even when you talked about the OPE, you had to include all the operators.
That's right, but if you remember there, I picked a specific conformal family, and I defined the block as being the contribution of a particular family. These guys define different conformal families, these multi-traces. And the difference is that these guys don't have a dual in terms of an ADS field. The ADS CFT dictionary is between low energy fields in the ADS, the supergravity fields in ADS, and single trace operators on the boundary. These guys are more mysterious. They don't have the simple correspondence to bulk fields as the single traces do.
I thought your previous argument was completely generic. You just use CFT and you show for any primary field you get.
Yes, but the ADS picture, however, is there only if my field has a dual.
Well, if you start from the CFT, it's, you're trying to construct the dual. Let's not use it.
I'm not trying to construct a dual, I'm trying to derive a correspondence. So I can build the OPE blocks for any family, and this will have the nice properties as being like propagating in this kinematic space I described and all that. However, if there is no available field that is dual to my operator, then I can't integrate over a geodesic because there's no corresponding excitation in the bulk.
So what was the limitation of the previous result? The previous result is not always valid.
It is valid for all the families, for all the single trace families, mm-hmm. for the conformal families of the operators that have a dual in the ABS. Not all operators have a dual. For example, not all operators in the CFT have a low energy dual as a field.
Okay. I
can explain.
The previous result was that it works. Okay, I don't know. It looks like previously you were saying that it always works, and now you're saying it doesn't always work. Maybe I don't understand.
Well,
was supposed to say any primary operator has this interpretation. Any guy entering the
CFT definition of the blocks is completely general, and you can define it for any family. But the point is that not all families correspond to a bulk field. Single trace families have a dual field in the bulk, which I can integrate over geodesics. So what am I going to integrate over a geodesic if there's no corresponding bulk field? So the correspondence, of course, is limited by the basic ADA CFT assumptions that there's got to exist a corresponding dual. So what I'm trying to argue is that these double trace or these multi-trace blocks are not dual to local fields, but they're needed in order to recover the interacting picture. These guys have a more intricate role in the holographic dictionary. Let's discuss about it more in detail if you still have questions. Good. So the question that we want to ask at this point is that, well, we observe this series of blocks now being dual to these geodesic operators. Well, the question is, I can of course derive these coefficients by just using bulk perturbation theory, but the question is there a CFT reason why I should build these objects? Do they define some kind of natural structure in the CFT? That would be an interesting thing if we can uncover such a connection. So you've seen such a structure before. It's not completely unfamiliar. You've seen such a structure in two-dimensional CFTs. In two-dimensional CFTs, local conformal symmetry allows us to organize OPEs into larger structures. This is what I will call the Virasoro OPE blocks. The idea is simple. These Virasoro OPE blocks contain not just the contribution of the global descendants, which I already included before, but of all the local descendants of the primary operator. Let's go a little bit under the hood and see exactly what's happening. So the idea is the following. An OPE can be expressed in terms of global blocks of quasi-primary operators. At the same time, it can be expressed as an expansion of Virasoro blocks of primary operators. What's the connection between them? Well, the Virasoro block is just the sum of global blocks. What sum? Well, local maps, local conformal maps, can take me from one global family to another. And there's a series of families that are connected by local conformal transformations. For example, for the identity, well, its global block is trivial, it's just one times this prefactor here. But the local conformal transformation can take me to a stress tensor, or to a product of two stress tensors, and so on and so forth. So the idea is that this Virasoro OPE block, which is defined by its transformation properties, the fact that it has to transform covariantly under local maps, is built by a sum of all these individual global blocks, which I schematically draw in terms of these causal diamonds. So we see that this Virasoro block is essentially captures the essence of what local bulk interactions do in the previous discussion. This, of course, extends in arbitrary families. One can take the Virasoro block of an arbitrary primary operator is essentially the global block, which we were talking about before, dressed with a series of all these other blocks, which are essentially associated with the descendants of the global block. So this series is precisely what we saw before, and the natural question is, well, is this related to what I was talking about before? Is this related to the interacting picture that we're trying to construct? Well, the answer is yes. So what I would like to claim is the following. The Virasoro block for the identity is the exponential of the operator that measures the length of the geodesic in the block with an appropriate prefactor. And the Virasoro block of an arbitrary family is dual to is equal to the same exponential times the geodesic operator, but now the geodesic operator is able to capture all interactions with gravity. This is what I would like to claim, but this is what I will actually prove. What I will prove is that this is true in a subset of states, what I will call semi-classical states. So what I mean by semi-classical states? Well, roughly speaking, semi-classical states are states that have potentially a classical geometric dual. I don't need all the power of semi-classicality in order to make that statement. I just need the following fact, that states with a classical geometry essentially have a large expectation value for the metric tensor, but a small fluctuation of the metric, a parametrically small fluctuation. In the CFT, this can be captured roughly by the following assumption, that we talk about states which have a large expectation value of the stress tensor, but all of its correlation functions are parametrically suppressed. That's a necessary requirement for a classical dual, but not a sufficient one. So in these states, I can perform the following background expansion. It's convenient to, since I have a large expectation value, to redefine my stress tensor and expand it about the classical background, this expectation value. And this delta t is just a small fluctuation on top of that. When I do this expansion, the Virasoro blocks themselves decompose. There's a piece that depends only on the expectation value and a piece that depends on both the expectation value and the fluctuation. This is what I call the semi-classical block. So this piece of the block is exactly what I call semi-classical and what I told you that is dual to this bulk operator. So I don't have a lot of time to explain the proof in detail, but I'll give you a flavor of it. The idea is the following. Semi-classical states are essentially described by their energy density. This is the only non-trivial. We already said that all correlations of the stress tensor are suppressed. So that's the only relevant thing. Now define a function f, which is the solution to this differential equation, where now this object here is a Schwarzian. This is a formal object, but essentially tells me that if I can find an f that satisfies this relation, that reproduces the expectation value of the stress tensor that I want, then I can find a frame, a local conformal frame, in which my state looks like the vacuum. Now, this function may not be single-valued, they may have branch cuts in general, but the idea is that there exists a frame, a local frame, in which this becomes a vacuum. But if I can show that geodesic operators and the Virasoro blocks transform the same way under local maps, then the proof of the general correspondence I talked about before comes from the global proof, the proof that we already did in the beginning. Well, the point is that one can show that, in fact, geodesic operators and Virasoro blocks do transform the same way. So that's the spirit of the proof. So we found this connection. And there's another thing that I would like to give you an idea about, which is the following. We define these objects in order to start incorporating interactions. And we saw that we can actually gravitationally dress our geodesic operators, and this becomes again a natural structure in the CFT. But that's not the only thing that we gain from this approach. We actually find a natural way to describe these gravitationally dressed operators in the CFT alone. Well, in the other framework that I introduced you to, this kinematic space. These objects can be thought of as objects of their own, satisfying not their own mathematics, but there's a mathematical formula to describe them. And let me give you a glimpse of what I mean by this. the length in the geodesic length in these cases can be decomposed to a holomorphic, a left moving piece and a right moving piece. These U and Vs are just the left moving and right moving null coordinates. And the idea is that this length of each of these individual guys lives in the two components of the kinematic space I described before, and it satisfies this nonlinear equation. J here is there to include possible sources that I can have in kinematic space. This is a structure that was already hinted in the work by Heller and Myers and collaborators. And another fact is that the geodesic operator themselves, the geodesic operator, satisfy also an equation in this kinematic space, which is now this. This is essentially, we now see that in this case, the metric on kinematic space is essentially defined in terms of this object omega. This is true for both the left moving and the right moving piece, by the way, independently. But this set of equations define a Liouville theory on kinematic space. We now see that the metric on kinematic space is not just fixed by conformal symmetry, it's fixed by this left moving piece of the length, which satisfies its own dynamics. This is a semi-classical approximation here. What I'm talking about this at the level of semi-classical fields, but and I don't really know how seriously one should take these equations. However, it's an encouraging fact that one can describe these objects using their own separate language. They're extended objects in the bulk, and it's nice to see that they have a convenient way of describing them. So let's see what I tried to convince you of in this talk. The first one is that geodesic integrals of free fields correspond to global OPE blocks. This was a kinematical correspondence which helped us make sense of various other results and start building our gauge invariant approach to ADS-CFT. The second fact that I was trying to explain is the fact that gravitational dressing of the geodesic operators in 2 plus 1 dimensional ADS is dual to the Virasoro dressing of the OPE into taking the global OPE block and dressing it with all the descendants, all the local descendants of it, to make it covariant under local conformal maps. This is a natural procedure in the CFT. In general, the question of how do the dressed operators in ABS, how are they constructed in the bulk, in the CFT is generally a hard question. Now we have mapped it to a natural problem in the CFT. Of course, it was local conformal invariance that we exploited, so the general question is still open, but it's an encouraging fact. And we also saw, glimpsed, at least, that these operators have kind of a life of their own. They can be described in their own terms as fields propagating on kinematic space, satisfying this nonlinear equation. So, going back to the big picture, what are we trying to learn from that? Well, the first thing that there's a number of immediate questions that pop out of these advances. For example, can we actually take this Liouville theory seriously? There's a bunch of formulations of 2 plus 1 gravity in ADS. Is there a connection between this formalism that we're describing, this kinematic formalism, and the other connections in terms of Chern-Simons theory, for example? And can we actually think of this Liouville theory as being a quantum theory itself? Is the quantum theory in this kinematic space? Another question, which of course was the original motivation for this whole work, is can we identify the CFT principle, a more general principle, not relying on symmetries, which defines the dressed blocks for arbitrary interactions? We made the first step. What is the case for general interactions? What is the property of the CFT that builds them? And is there a useful kinematic space description for these objects? And finally, one would like to use such a full-fledged formalism to answer perhaps two kind of deep questions. For example, can we use these objects to see inside black holes? That's one question. And the other question is, well, we see that this correspondence, which looks so natural in the CFT, kind of suggests a complementary approach to gravitational observables. Usually people just start with the local operators and dress them with appropriate Wilson lines or other constructions of that type. These are all natural constructions from the perspective of the bulk, from the perspective of the local QFT, However, there's no guarantee that this is really the most convenient language to talk about gravity. So perhaps this approach can actually teach us about how we should be thinking of operators in more general backgrounds, like, for example, flat space or de Sitter space. However, these are more speculative questions. So this is all I had to say. And on behalf of my collaborators, thank you very much for your attention.
More questions?
I have a question about this gravitational dressing. If I understand properly, in the first section, you just look at what you call global conformal blocks, which are essentially a representation of a set to R, the left movement. Now, the gravitational dress ones are now representations of the full Virasoro.
Okay.
So you know exactly how they behave at the quantum level. So now, the question is, you could look at the geometrical meaning of these Virasoros. That's what you're after, right? Because that's essentially you have the sets of, instead of three equations, you now have an infinite sets of, you know, Virasoro equations. So did you look at that, or what's the...
So I'm not entirely sure I understand the question. The Virasoro blocks are fixed.
Yeah, they're controlled by the symmetry. It's just the symmetry group is bigger.
That's right, yeah.
Okay? Instead of SL2R, you just have the full Virasoro. So why don't you implement that thing you did in the first step?
Looking well, that's essentially what I implement.
Okay, yeah.
I mean,
at the quantum level, you can just look at a quantum representation of the Virasoro group.
You mean in order to prove the correspondence of the dressed operator with the full quantum operator in the box?
It's just representation of the Virasoro group.
Yes, the subtle part there is that it may not be entirely clear how to think of the geodesic operator in the full quantum theory. In general, I define it as a geodesic operator that kind of implicitly has an assumption that I have a classical background on which I'm defining the geodesic. So one would perhaps have to do a little bit more work to exactly explain what they mean by geodesic operators in that case. The Virasoro block story, of course, carries over in a general case. I don't have to restrict myself to the semi-classical objects. But we found it easier to make the connection to the bulk at the place where we have the safety of a classical geometry on which I can define geodesics. Now, it could be that this correspondence can be made more general. It's just that...
You could do better. Instead of assuming the bulk, you just look at the Virasoro symmetry representation and look at the representation theory to tell you how you should think about a quantum bulk.
That's right.
Instead of pulling back this classical bulk all the time.
Yeah, so that's definitely an interesting question. I don't know what the answer to it is. But all I can tell you is that for the cases where I can have a meaningful classical geometry, these do correspond to these geodesic operators I've been talking about.
In concerning the questions I had about what you were calling the higher trace operator, I understood they were just the descendant.
In this particular context, in this particular context, yeah, it's just the descendants because, well.
There's no need to call them higher trace.
Well, if I want to.
Some other context.
Good, so for this case where I have this symmetry, of course, these are just the descendants. These are just the quasi primaries I can build out of local descendants of my primary. But for more general interactions, there's no symmetry there, there's no notion of descendants. So the corresponding operators whose block I need to include are these double trace operators, which are not available in every theory. These are available in certain theories which are holographic.
Yes, they're available in theories which have higher symmetries, like if you have black movie currents, then you can
In every theory where I have symmetry, this corresponds.
Then you have more notions of descendants.
That's right. But eventually, we do want to go beyond symmetry. Eventually, we do want to talk about dynamics which are not associated with the gauge group in the bulk. We want to talk about just the purely local interactions, just the cubic vertex of scalar fields. There's no dual CFT symmetry for that.
Yeah, okay.
In that case, I'm going to have to use a more elaborate technique in order to discuss what these blocks are. There are some hints of how one can actually talk about them for a general interaction, but I don't have time to explain to it now. And it's actually research in progress, so I can't really report on it. But yeah, for as long as there are symmetries, I can always play this game. It's just that we try to use the symmetries here as our testing ground, that our approach makes sense, and we're trying to identify the principle that will give us a local interaction, a purely polynomial interaction in the bulk, for example. Yes?
So for general interactions, do you think there will be some kind of emergent symmetry when you go to some class?
So that's a good question. Okay, so that's very recent. There's no emergent symmetry in the sense of an actual global symmetry or a local symmetry that emerges. But we have hints that the right way of thinking about these blocks is in the context of crossing symmetry. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in general, these OP blocks, if I take the correlation function of two of them, I define a conformal block. But conformal blocks have branch cuts. I can't make them. I can't, if I have these two, a conformal block between these two pairs of points, I can't cross it over here because I have branch cuts. It's not multivalued. So the hints that we have is that by defining OP blocks that have trivial monodromies is the answer to the general interaction problem. That by building OP blocks that are natural from the perspective of crossing symmetry is really the reason why the bulk organizes these objects in this way. So this is kind of the hint that we have. But of course, you're going to have to wait because it's still a work in progress. I can talk about it offline more.
Thank you.
Thank you.